Ike is the principal economic advisor for Senator Orrin Hatch. Prior to that, he was chief economist for the Joint Economic Committee of Congress, where he worked on congestion pricing and road financing. He has also been an economist for the Office of Management and Budget and associate professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, and Indiana University. He graduated from Augustana College and Indiana University. Ike, come and tell us the worst.
Thank you very much, Gabriel, for that that introduction. I have a couple of small town comments for Tom and DJ. I actually went to graduate school, as I said, for an exceedingly long period of time in Bloomington, Indiana. And there was another issue almost 20 years ago about foreigners coming in and taking over. It didn't have to do with roads. It had to do with the lottery. And what happened in about 1990 or 1991, the word went out that a group of foreign investors were buying up as many lottery tickets as they possibly could in order to corner the market on lotteries. And this became, believe it or not, a front page headline of the Bloomington Herald Telephone every day for a period of weeks. And I'm convinced what made it a big time headline were two words that went together: foreign syndicate. I mean, syndicate just has this terribly negative connotation. And whenever, you know, I still look at the Bloomington paper and the Chicago Tribune, of course, I'm a Midwestern person, and whenever I read about your deal in the Skyway and the Indiana Toll Roads, the two words that I always saw were foreign syndicate. So what we need to do is ban the word syndicate from the English language, and I think you guys would be much better off. And my one thought, listening to Tom talk, and other people brought this up about the lack of kind of downstate support in Illinois and Indiana for these tolling projects, as they see it only having possibly any impact or benefit or to people in the big city. Actually, the reverse happened in Wisconsin. When I was living in Wisconsin, of course, there was the planning for the rebuild of the Marquette Interchange, which is where Interstate 94 hits Interstate, I can't remember my interstates. What's the one that goes all the way up to? 43 that goes all the way up to Green Bay. And our good friends Kevin Susi came up with a plan to totally privatize this thing. And of course, the predictable opposition came to this. How dare you do this? How can you take this? And of course, it first was in Milwaukee. And initially, you saw the Madison paper write about how terrible a thing this is. And then quickly, of course, all the small towns like Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and Appleton, and Green Bay figured out, look, if this thing is privatized, there's so much more money that's going to be made available for all these other projects that are outside of Milwaukee. And if they don't do that, the Milwaukee Interchange is so massive, the cost that they were projecting, it was going to suck up every single excess dollar of transportation funds. So what you saw very quickly, the downstate, non-big city rest of the state dynamic was totally reversed from what you saw in Chicago. It was the people in the small towns who were adamant that this thing needed to be privatized. But the gist of my message is that I think the political exigencies of the time are going to require that we look much, much harder at that. And I say that not because I'm spending a lot of time studying transportation these days in the Senate Finance Committee. I'm not. But I'm studying other issues that I think are going to tie the hands of policymakers in wanting to spend more money on transportation. Next slide, please. I think the biggest problem we have facing us in terms of economics, in terms of fiscal policy, is this gigantic structural deficit that we have in the United States. And by structural deficit, I mean the promised benefits we have made in terms of Social Security, Medicare, and government pension obligations compared to the taxes that we have dedicated to those benefits that are going to be coming in from today on into infinity. The GAO estimates that deficit is, the present value of that deficit is a staggering $61 trillion, and other economists believe that that's actually substantially understating it, that it might be more closer to $70 trillion. And what's more, every single year, as we have more and more people enter the ranks of the retired and people live a little bit longer, that deficit, structural deficit, increases by $2 or $3 trillion a year. And Again, this, you know, keep in mind, these are my own opinions. Don't pin me down as representing anyone on the Senate Finance Committee. But our ability or inclination to deal with this, at least for the next two or three years, is really going to be suspect, right? The Republicans and the Democrats, for not just political reasons, but I think for closely held, sincere beliefs, have come to an impasse. And I think it's going to take two or three more years before we really start thinking about long and hard how we're going to deal with this deficit. But I think everyone, people in both parties, realize something has to be done in the near future. I think we know at least one step of what the Democrats would do, and at least one small step, and that is to repeal the Bush tax cuts when they come due in 2011, when they expire, if not before then. But if you look at people who have done the fiscal analysis, that's not nearly going to be enough to close the gap. And other kind of sensible proposals, or not so sensible proposals, I suppose, depending on where you're at, such as removing the cap on the Social Security tax, or maybe means testing to some degree Social Security benefits, ideas certainly not endorsed by anyone, but have been things that have been talked about. None of those get us remotely close to closing that fiscal gap. In fact, Jagadish Gokhale, former colleague of mine and a current professor, fellow at the Cato Institute, has done a number of studies, and he estimates that there is actually no tax rate alone that will close our fiscal deficit. That, you know, if you think about people's incentives and how they change, no matter how, even if you're only a very moderate supply sider and you feel the increase in tax rates only triggers a very small response, still the amount of tax increase that we would need to see would simply stifle so much effort and also encourage a lot more evasion that he believes it simply cannot be done by taxes alone. It's just literally impossible. So given that this squeeze is on, and given that it might be very, very difficult to deal with this in its totality, what are going to be the implications in terms of building roads? Well, I think one thing is that we're going to see spending on non-entitlement programs being dramatically reduced. I think the forecast that I've seen is that in the next, right now, federal spending is about 20% of GDP, maybe just a little bit above that, maybe closer to 21%. If we just go on the current trends and you just project what will happen to Social Security and Medicare based on demographics, and we can project 20 years out for senior citizen programs with some great degree of reliability, that will go from 20% to 30%. Our federal government size would grow 50% larger, and that's going to be a significant constraint on all non-entitlement programs. And I suspect that roads would be fairly close to the top of the list. And I say that, of course, fully realizing the political benefits of building roads. Right? It's something that's very tangible. It's something that politicians are very happy to be able to hand over to their constituents. And what I'm suggesting is that while there's definitely a political cost to less federal spending on roads and maybe turning it more over to the private sector, I suspect that in the cost-benefit analysis that this political calculus will change. And I think it's going to change when people are told that if we don't go to some kind of tolling, at least for some significant portion of our roads, taxes are going to have to go up considerably. Also, in terms of political developments, I think attitudes are changing on both sides of the aisle. When I first got to the Joint Economic Committee, very early on I fell into cahoots with Beth Pinkston, recently retired from the Congressional Budget Office. And one of the things that Beth was really good about helping us out is educating senators and their staff on what congestion pricing is, on what tolling can do. And we would go to, most of the time, we would go to Republican offices, but we went to people on both sides of the aisle, and kind of the calculus that we would often get told by all kinds of people. Well, look, we can't support this being good Republicans because tolls equals money going to government equals taxes equals bad. You're a bad Republican for suggesting this. And you'd be amazed at the number of people who just kind of threw this out there. And in fact, there were Republican activists who took this as their position. And if you wanted to sign the Grover Norquist pledge, you had to pledge against tolls. To Grover's credit, once people like Gary Blank, who's now chief of staff of the Council of Economic Advisors, kind of explained to him and let him know, understand that this really isn't a toll, Grover and all kinds of people who consider themselves very fiscally conservative started to embrace tolling as a way out of this mess. And I think the new calculus, political calculus, that some, but not certainly not everybody, are making on the right is just as I have that there. Congestion is now a family that really an issue that really impacts the family, and that a market for roads, at least from the Republican perspective, is something that should be welcome regardless of who collects the money. It'd be better if you're a pure free market libertarian that money was collected by a private entity rather than the government. But if we're half a loaf is better than none at all. And then I don't want to denigrate anyone on the left side of the aisle, because I think there have been a lot of people who have done some great work on this issue and have really done a lot to spread it. And Michael Replogle of Environmental Defense, I think, has been very valuable on the Hill. He communicates very well and has written quite well on this. But I think one of my frustrations with the battle, the liberals, is that I don't think they really fully appreciate the environmental benefits of going to something like privatization and congestion pricing and something that would dramatically eliminate the congestion out there, right? Most of our emissions that come from cars come from congestion, and something that dramatically reduces congestion would just have all kinds of benefits. We can talk about it in the context of family because we have more time with our family, we can shorten commute times. But if you talk about environmental, it seems like this ought to be something that the people on the far right and the people on the far left can join together. And Lord knows we don't have enough of those things. And I think, you know, I talked about how foreign syndicate, just these two little words, can really make something 20 years later kind of blow up on you and make life a lot more difficult. I think Lexus lanes is another example of that. That is just stuck in the lexicon of so many people when they think about this. And if you talk to people like my parents who think about this once or twice a year, I mean, that's the only thing they really know about congestion pricing. And that's really something that we need to overcome. And it's interesting that there's this, that the competition about how to present congestion pricing, the poster, I don't know if many of you have received this. I think that's a great idea. We need, if $1,000 is going to be a bargain, if there's some graduate student out there who comes up with a great way to express the advantages of this, we need more of that. I think that's $1,000 well spent. What else is needed to kind of spread this out there? And you know what I point out is that we really need more success stories about privatized roads and congestion pricing. And as someone who's from not only from the Midwest, but he's from the most Midwestern town in the world, Peoria, Illinois, Europe or California don't count as the rest of the world. California might as well be somewhere in Mars. And something that works in California has absolutely no relevance in people's lives in Peoria. My sister just moved back to Peoria from doing 8 years or 9 years of her medical training, the last year of which was spent with her husband in LA. And I tell my people just how ecstatic my sister is to finally have left that hell of Southern California and returned back to Peoria, Illinois. And it just astounds people. People are really like that. And I think one other thing we need, besides kind of one great success story that everyone can get their hands on, is we need kind of a fervent advocate of these ideas in Congress. I think one person who was really in a great position to do that and was doing a great job was Congressman Mark Kennedy. You know, a smart, energetic guy, and I'm really hoping that things work out, and he might be the person in the Senate. But if not, I hope there's somebody who's willing to pick that up, because sometimes it really just takes that one person who's willing to fight for this. But in 2009, which is when our next reauthorization bill comes up in the U.S. Senate, I think that there's going to be all kinds of constraints on people, and even to spend the amount of money that we're spending on roads right now. And to think that, well, we can just increase spending by increasing the gasoline tax, that might just be overly simplistic. It might be a situation where we're in such a crunch for revenue and people realize the long-term ramifications of not dealing with our structural deficit that we need to take some of that money from the gas tax and actually apply it to general revenue. Lord knows we've done that before. So anyway, thank you very much for listening.